Welcome to this week's edition or installment of The Boundless Show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson. And today I need to unload, let's see. Oh, I got a call from my sister yesterday. At work, actually. My sister calls me at work, and one of the reasons that I have my assistant is for the sole purpose of screening calls from my sister, who lives here in town. And I've told our admin this, and
this is a sister who did not send the Valentine's box.
She did not. Ooh, an update, everyone, because I know you're all sitting on pins and needles. I got a silver necklace from my sister, and then a huge bag of M&Ms. So anyway, but no, my other sister, who I'm just going to come out and say it, is crazy, called me almost in tears because she had read in the National Enquirer that apparently, which is her main source of news, apparently this zoo in Beijing is using, like, in their lion's den, they're taking an occasional goat out of another pen and just throwing it into the lions, and then people can stand around and watch it be torn apart. That is not awesome. That's bad.
You know, people worry so much about these animals in captivity and say, oh, those poor animals. Have you ever watched a nature show? I mean, we watched a nature show once, and these wildebeest were in Africa going across the stream, and every third wildebeest was bitten in half by an alligator.
I know, but if it's like naturally happening, that's okay.
Or maybe it was a crocodile.
Well, the whole point of the call wasn't that a goat was being torn apart. It was that my sister, who, when my family, when she grew up, my parents were missionaries in the Philippines, and my sister had goats. So she had a very personal connection with the fact that these goats are being pulled apart. So she's almost in tears. I'm, like, trying to do things here at work, and I'm, like, talking to her on the phone, like, And she doesn't know how to work the internet. She doesn't have email. She doesn't have a computer. So she's like, okay, Lisa, I need you to take down this email address. It's this ambassador to China. You need to email him and tell him that they should not be tearing apart goats in the zoo.
Because
okay? That's
why to write, not all the human
violations. And then there's a guy from, like, the SPCA also that his...
I'm sure they would respond to that email.
Anyway, I just thought it was hilarious that, like, I'm supposed to be her mediator for working out the goat situation by emailing the ambassador to China and this guy from the SPCA, who is doing some kind of crusade or something. So anyway, I was just like,
anytime you're thinking, where's my secretary who's supposed to be screening this phone call?
So on Wednesday nights, I help out with the high school girls at church, though we're not actually at church, we're in someone's home. I just want to make that distinction. Anyway, but I brought up the topic. Our sermon on Sunday was on compassion. We're actually doing 3 weeks of basically pushing back the effects of the fall is kind of what we're talking about. And so this past week was on compassion, and one of the women asked, you know, well, what is compassion, was asking the girls. And I brought up this week's article in Boundless by Tim Challies called Involuntary Community. And I'd actually forwarded it to a lot of my single friends because I felt, first of all, it was very impactful to me.
Ooh, impactful. That's not a word.
Sorry. It is.
It's a wisdom teeth word.
It was very super. I'll just say that. And just the whole concept, I don't know, for those of you out there that read it, the whole concept of the fact that we gravitate towards people who are like us and what that looks like. And I think it's interesting that, you know, it is true. And I think he even uses the example of how when you go on Facebook, you know, most people join Facebook groups that have, like, similar interests or whatever. You know, I wouldn't necessarily go on and be like, where are all the goth groups? You know, because that's not necessarily me. But
necessarily.
What does that? Yeah, not necessarily. I mean, it could be any day now,
yeah, right.
But who
Maybe
knows?
Next Wednesday.
Exactly. So, but anyway, it was a very interesting article in thinking about, you know, I don't know, just many of the differences or how we gravitate, I guess, towards people we know, and how that breeds kind of a consumer mentality within the church, I guess. And so my question kind of is, you know, is there a consumer mentality within the church, and is that specifically reflected, like, within our demographic?
I was going to say about the involuntary community is that that's supposed to be a distinguisher between the church and the world, is that you are involved with people who are annoying, who are different from you, that you have to love and serve anyway. And so
I think that already is at a point further down the line than most people even get to, because from our experience, churches are so big that it's easy to just go on Sunday and participate and tithe and, I mean, do the basic things and, you know, volunteer in the kids' Sunday school class. But I don't think it's just singles who have a hard time feeling like they can find a place within a church. I think a lot of churches are made up of people who aren't really sure how to plug in.
Well, I think it is a problem in a bigger church because you can do that. You can blend in. You can just kind of find the people who are just like you and really not get involved.
Well, I'm not sure we've even found people just like us. It's just hard to meet people in a big church. I mean, you can just go on Sunday or not go. Nobody would ever even know you weren't there.
Well, you have to be intentional. I mean, you really do have to get involved and with other people in the church, invite them over, get to know them outside the church, you know, serve in the church, and it has to be intentional.
Okay, so what's the game plan then for the 28-year-old guy who decides that, no, he won't go climbing on Sunday, he will go to church, and he'll show up at one that's down the street from him and give it a shot. So he walks in the door. What should we be doing?
We should encourage him to say hi to people.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then we...
and we should try to say hi to him as well.
And the married couple should reach out to him.
Absolutely.
I mean, I have noticed singles, some single men in the church and have often thought, well, I wonder, does he have plans after service? You know, why don't we reach out? We need to do that.
Yeah. We did just start I'm kind of excited about this. We just started a welcome center at our church that they announced, like you're supposed to go to the welcome center right after the service. And I've been actually shocked at how many people do, even singles, because then what we do is we man the center with singles. And then that way we can personally walk them over to the junior high that they have to go to in order to attend their Sunday school class. And we have, I will just say it, lured many people into our net as a result of that and have built friendships with them. And now they're more invested and involved.
Does
in
your
church,
single Sunday school class have any older couples in it?
Yeah, it does. Okay, we kind of have mentor couples. And our goal has been to, you know, as people get married within the group, to keep them there. But that's a whole other thing, is that for some reason when people get married, they feel that they need to go to a young marrieds class, and so we have a hard time keeping them. I don't think it's just singles. I think it's people that just feel they want to be with their age and stage. I don't know. I mean,
I have a hard time with that whole mentality, period. You know, I know a lot of people that it's like, well, I just haven't found any friends because, you know, I'm single and everybody's married, or like married people that are like, well, you know, I just talk with now with the moms, talk to the moms. And I'm always like, why can't we just see people as people? Mm-hmm. Like, you know what? That person seems pretty cool. I'm going to talk to them. I don't care if they're single or married. I don't care if they're 70 or you know, you find the people that you connect with that you think are cool, and stop taking everybody and compartmentalizing them into, well, I'm not going to talk to that person.
Well, maybe not even just people who you think are cool, but people
who look
lonely.
Yeah, you need to talk to the weirdos too, Patrick. Come on.
Well, or just people who...
Well, there you go.
Who's...
Because no one's talking to Maude, apparently, so please do give him a shout-out when you visit his church.
Yeah, but who's sitting there with no one else to talk to? I used to really freak out trying to get the best seat whenever you go into a room. You know, you go in a little late, and you're thinking, oh, I got to get the best seat. My dad used to say, Candy. He called me Candy. You need to look for who is sitting alone. Who could you minister
to? Good.
Pick a seat next to someone who looks lonely. And don't worry if you're not in the best seat. And that took all the pressure off. And I still hear him going, look for someone who's lonely and sit by them. That is what, I mean, that's our Christian calling.
That's I think a big thing that keeps people from doing that, again, I've used this Christianese kind of phrase, fear of man. But I think a lot of people are apprehensive of doing something new and potentially scary, and maybe that person's going to slap them or kick their shin or something.
Yeah, that's crazy. No,
or
I think
that you're goofy for saying hi to somebody that you don't know.
If you can just get so far as to smile at someone and say, hi, my name is, and fill in the blank, I think you'd be surprised how warmly most people would receive that, because they're feeling just as insecure as you are.
At the end of
you
the service,
have a follow-up
not in the middle.
Question.
Not in the middle
hi,
of the service.
Hi, my name is, and then... How long have you been coming here?
Right, they just stare at you blankly.
Because we do that. And in a big church, you have to do that. You don't say, are you new? No,
Sundays.
Because they probably aren't.
Yeah, the worst thing is when everybody assumes you're new and you've been there for 8 years.
Yeah.
Okay, so the moral of the story is get to church this weekend. Go to one that is near you instead of driving out to the suburban ghetto or somewhere that is not even in your sphere, or following some radio preacher that you'll never talk to personally anyway. And then go into the church. Do not sit in the back row. Talk to someone. Maybe sit next to someone that looks lonely.
Yeah, or just looks like they're
because you know
there
you are
themselves.
Too. Yeah. So, go sit next to them. And then what? And then
just resign yourself to get involved.
Here's the thing: when you sit in the bench,
it's uncomfortable. You may not want to.
These are friends that you don't yet know.
This is what God calls us to do.
Here's the rule: God calls us to community. Slide in really close to the person. Don't sit on the edge with six spaces in between for coats. Slide in and say, "Hey, good morning."
And then, if there's opportunity, just start a spontaneous singing of "I'm so glad I'm a part of the family of God" when you get a chance. That's if you're in the Baptist churches. Baptist churches are all about that. So.
You know, sometimes I think we think so hard about all this, too, and forget that, you know, God just kind of directs us if we ask him. And so a lot of times when I'm at church, and I'm at a small church now, but I just simply, in the middle of the service, I'm just like, you know, Lord, just send me to wherever I need to go at the end of this. Because that might be someone that I know is new. It might be someone that I do know, but that's who I need to talk to today, or someone I haven't connected with in a while. And if everybody just kind of went in there with this idea of like, you know, Lord, this isn't all about me just being fed. This is about me being there for other people. So show me where you want me to go today. And that's the end of it. You know, I think he'll probably connect us all with the people that we need to be connected with.
Yeah, that's good.
Which, yeah, points to another good soapbox that if you are truly spending your Sundays as the Sabbath and setting them aside as the Lord's Day and budgeting that time, you should have the time to build into other people, to be involved in the church, to spend time at church on Sunday if you don't already have plans to go to Target and to go climbing and to finish up your laundry and do all this other stuff. So that's a little soapbox of mine, but we won't get into that now. So, all right, well, this has been a good discussion. Thank you all very much for your contributions. All right, with me for our culture segment, I have Candace Waters, and we're going to talk about a film that I saw with a friend this weekend, and I'm sure many of you out there have seen this film. It's actually up for an Academy Award, which is pretty amazing because it's kind of another indie film, which we love to talk about on this podcast. It's called Juno. And it's kind of a, in fact, I was talking to someone about it yesterday, and we kind of talked about it as almost a backhanded, it has a backhanded pro-life message.
Well, everything I'm reading about it says that any pro-abortion film is sort of passe now. That is because it's the expected outcome, and so now what's unexpected is for the characters to keep their babies.
Yeah.
So that's the new plot line.
Yeah, and it's a little jarring just because well, first of all, I need to say that it is set in Minnesota, which just makes it fabulous to begin with.
So everybody's freezing the entire movie.
This film actually goes through all seasons.
Oh, good. So in the summer, they're still wearing parkas.
So it's not just winter, which is great. But it's a very quirky film and very well done. And the dialogue, really the script is great. But I think it's a very interesting message to the movie because it's about this, I'll just summarize it quickly. It's about this girl who is in high school, finds out that she is pregnant, and through kind of a weird series of events, a visit to an abortion clinic, basically, she decides to keep the baby because the clinic kind of freaks her out. And so it goes through her whole pregnancy and the process of choosing a couple to whom she's going to give this baby. And then it addresses all of this couple's issues and their relationship with her and kind of how the whole thing plays out. And I think it's an interesting thing to discuss as far as just the whole concept of, you know, really this 16-year-old girl coming up with these huge, I mean, she has to make this huge decision basically as it plays out, and just the people that are involved, her dad and her stepmom, and everyone's trying to give her input and how she has to.
She's not the typical 16-year-old though, is she?
She's not. No, she's the one that's like very smart but a little bit odd and kind of, you know, a loner in the school, and she likes the guy that got her pregnant is kind of geeky, but he, you know, is a great guy and he's also smart and whatever. So,
and what happens with their relationship? I mean, is there any, do they ever talk about marriage, or is that just not even an option?
They don't talk about marriage, but they do. I'm trying to figure out how to say this without giving away the plot. They do end up, I mean, the relationship is kind of preserved. They still, I mean, they're not in a relationship throughout the entire movie, but they do realize, I mean, their relationship is dealt with pretty healthily, I think, as far as that goes. But yeah, but it's just a very, like, again, I mean, it, just the whole concept of, you know, here's this girl who is 16 years old, who is looking at a life ahead of her. And most movies, as you said, Candace, would say, you know, well, you need to move on with your life. You need to obviously, you know, look and see where you're heading. And in order to do that, you have to terminate this pregnancy. And she's doing this throughout the film while at the same time determined to, you know, carry the baby to term and then deal with this couple that the woman cannot have a baby. And so what's all the drama that they're going through?
Well,
in the midst
and I
of that?
Do love that she decides to give the baby up for adoption, because the reality of a 16-year-old mom keeping the baby, and that often is the desire when you find out you're pregnant and you realize it's a real person, it's a real baby. You see the ultrasound, which is becoming more common, and young girls are thinking, oh, it's a baby. I want to keep this baby. Mm-hmm. But it is such a hard road to go by yourself. And so I love that they've said adoption is a good option. Mm-hmm. I mean, to hear that from Hollywood is a great message.
Yeah. And what's very interesting is when she first finds out she's pregnant, she finds this couple like in a little weekly circular, just like the little local paper in the ad section. And she goes and meets with them and she's like, of course I'm going to give you this baby. Like, to her, she has no emotional connection to it whatsoever. But you can see throughout the pregnancy how she becomes a little more attached to it. And I think the decision for her becomes a little more difficult. But she still wants a healthy future for the baby. And she wants what's best for the baby. And she wants, you know, it's, you know, for her, it's just all science on the front end. And she's like, yeah, you know, this thing, you know, she uses all the euphemisms, you know, just the bun in the oven and the whatever. And it's just kind of like, yeah, I need to just pop it out and I'll hand it over to you. We'll sign the papers and it'll be done.
And it becomes more complicated.
Becomes a little more complicated, not in the sense that she's really torn, but you can see that she, you know, the process of understanding what she is doing and what this life, you know, ultimately is, becomes more of a process for her. And I think it's fascinating that this film, you know, in the way that it's done, is up for Best Picture, actually, which is pretty unprecedented in the sense that when you look at Best Picture things in the recent years,
right, they've been pretty bad.
They've been pretty.
Do we need to give wacky. Any disclaimers on this movie?
I think we would, in the sense that, you know, there's a, you know, all the standard, you know, pluggedinonline.com, check it out, all the standard language, you know, definitely some, adult themes, some sexual content, whatever.
Surprise. She's pregnant.
Yeah. But,
well, it, you know, I'm really glad to hear that it's up for an award. I do wish though that Bella had gotten more support from the Academy. Fantastic movie. Review of Bella on boundless.org, and mm-hmm. Loved the way that they just, that movie was all about embracing life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and I think it's just a great example when you see films like this, how, you know, the power is in the hands of the consumer, and the movies that we go and see and the money that we pay at the box office is going not necessarily for the Oscars. I mean, that's a whole weird quagmire of whatever and who decides what that is. But really, when it comes down to the bottom line and who's going to show up and pay for these things, that determines the ultimate success and the ultimate longevity of a film.
That's right. And so note to movie makers, we like good stories.
We do. We like good stories with good,
real plots,
normal
human
people.
That's right. That's
plausible
right.
characters right. who are going through real situations and yeah, and aren't, you know, killing 10 people during the course of the script. So anyway, it's just, I mean, not that we're going to go out and recommend films, but if you want something to talk about with your friends and with your peers and whatnot, both of those films, Bella
certainly, yeah,
and Juno.
Neither one a Christian, overtly Christian film. These are just good stories, well done, and they support life.
Definitely. So, yeah, check them out and let us know what you think. Email us, editor@boundless.org, and give us your feedback. And now, here's Kara Schwab with this week's edition of The Hungry Years.
Childhood memories are interesting. It seems the older I get, the hazier they become, except for a few that are seared into my brain. Some of those are as vivid to me now as the day they happened. One in particular involves me as a little kid sleeping in my narrow twin bed with my big Italian grandma. Technically, I imagine she did most of the sleeping, in between her snoring and snorting and other sorts of loud bodily sounds that would startle the daylights out of you and wake you up from the deepest REM sleep you could ever fall into. My 5-year-old body would be pressed up against the wall, my nose touching the seam of the 1970s orange, yellow, and brown plaid wallpaper in my bedroom. And I'd never know if that was her big belly or her big backside that was smashed into my little frame. Because this woman was round, quite round. And while she slept, I just basically tried to stay alive and keep breathing. Some nights we'd talk for a little while before she'd suddenly fall asleep, usually mid-sentence with her mouth still open, ready to form her next word. And in the moonlight, I could see the hairs shine on her wrinkly upper lip, which always looked kind of funny and a little bit more pursed after she took out her full set of teeth. I'd like to try to make her laugh just to see that silly toothless grin. Wow, she had a hairy upper lip. And some nights after she'd fall asleep, I'd just look at her, and gently with my little fingers, I'd touch the softness of her neck and all six of her chins, and sometimes press my face into them and nestle into the warmth and strong smell of the Jean Nate body splash she doused herself with earlier that morning. And those nights, as we lay in my bed, she'd often talk about God. And my family didn't attend church during my early childhood, and I remember always being so intrigued with spiritual matters. Grams, who exactly is Jesus? I would ask. Incidentally, she'd always sounded a smidge exasperated when you asked her a question that seemed really obvious to her. I vividly remember asking her one day what the word procrastinate meant, and she would answer with two open-faced hands gesturing near her face like only a true Italian can, and simultaneously shrugging her shoulders, she'd say, well, Cara, procrastinate, you know, means to procrastinate. Oh, I would say, thanks. So when I'd ask about Jesus, and I often would, sometimes just to hear her say the S's in his name without any of her teeth in, she would say, well, you know, Jesus is God's son, and he wants to live in your heart. Well, one night, the truth of that just struck me. I thought about Jesus, God's son, wanting to live in my heart. I had to think about that some more. And I couldn't concentrate with her sudden snoring, so I wedged myself out from underneath her belly and went to the bathroom. And I looked in the mirror, and I repeated the words, Jesus wants to live in my heart. And I believed it, and I wanted it. So I knelt down in that little bathroom, and I prayed my first real prayer and asked Jesus to come and live in my heart. But then it dawned on me that if Jesus was God's son, he had to be really big. And then I became sad, and I wondered if he would think my heart was too small for him to fit. So I started to cry, and I prayed over and over, Jesus, I promise there's room. Jesus, I promise there's room enough for you to fit in my heart. I promise there's room. And I tear up thinking about it now, because as I look back at that 5-year-old heart, I realize it was bigger than it is now most days. And I believe the question is worth asking myself every day. Jesus, is there room in my heart for you today? I want my answer to be, I promise there's room. Jesus, help me make room.
All right, clicking on this week's Boundless Inbox, we have a question from a female listener for Candace. Candace is with me in the studio to answer this one. I keep reading these stupid romance novels, and I can't seem to stop. In reading them, I seem to always think about sex, a lot. I'm going to wait to get married, and I'm still a virgin, but what can I do in the meantime to stop? I know this isn't right.
You're right, it is a huge problem, and unfortunately, we live in a culture that most people you ask would say, what's the big deal? So I'm glad that you realize this is a problem. It really is like the female counterpart to the male online porn addiction. And it's that much less stigmatized in our culture, even in our churches. And so you really do have to look at this as a serious problem and maybe even an addiction if you feel like you're not able to put these books away. For starters, what can you do to stop? Clear off your bookshelf. If you own these books, throw them away. Don't give them away and create a problem for someone else. Take the books, throw them in the dumpster. Stop getting these books and bringing them into your house. You know, it's like somebody who has a weight problem who eats the chocolate in her home. If you quit buying the chocolate, it's going to be less likely that you're going to eat it. So not only that, not only clearing your shelves of the books, but filling your shelves with good books. Because there, you mentioned, I read the question earlier, and I know that you mentioned a love for good story. There are so many good stories out there that don't have a sinful sexual plot element. So if you can start to look for books that are uplifting, you know, scripture says to think on whatever is pure and excellent and praiseworthy, to fill your mind with these things. And that's the highest standard for a believer, to be filling your mind with thoughts that are honoring to God. You know, you mentioned a hope for marriage, and I would just encourage you that virginity is about so much more than just sexual purity and sexual inactivity prior to marriage. You want to have not just a virgin body, but a virgin heart and a virgin mind. And that requires purity of thought. And it may necessitate you possibly getting some Christian counseling if you really are struggling with not being able to end this behavior. But it may just be as simple as getting an accountability partner, to have someone who's asking you, what's on your reading list this week? What are you reading? If the library is a temptation, don't go to the library. If the bookstore is a temptation, don't go to the bookstore. Stop going places where you're tempted to dip into these books. And so again, it's not just the not aspect of this, the don't aspect or the stop aspect. It's the aspect of filling your mind and your free time with good things. There, get some good literature. Get some good Jane Austen books, or there are lists of good books. And, you know, I think we'll even post a couple of recommendations on the Boundless blog. I'm gonna blog about what some good alternatives would be, because I think it's good to fill your mind with stories, just not stories that are causing you to sin sexually.
Okay, so I have two follow-up questions, actually, for that. One being, what about these, like, women's magazines, for example, that do you think this falls in the same category of women's magazines that put out, like, those quizzes and polls for women to do? Like, do you think it's wrong for single women to be going in there and, you know, finding out, doing research, as women say, you know, for when they are married, about all these, like, sex polls and quizzes and info and top 10 lists of what, you know, whatever? What would you say to those?
When I was single, those magazines got me in trouble. I felt I definitely tried to steer clear of those magazines, because the articles get you thinking in a sexual way. They lead to sexual temptation and to ultimately to sin in your own mind. You don't have to be doing anything action-wise. You can be thinking in a way, and Christ was so clear about that. If you lust after a woman in your heart, you've already committed adultery with her. We have a standard of absolute purity, and that's what we should be shooting for. And so don't buy the magazines. I saw a woman with her daughter who looked like she was 16 or younger, and she just grabbed three of those magazines and the mom bought them. And I thought, oh, what are you doing buying that stuff for your daughter? I mean, that's just the antithesis of the kind of stuff we're supposed to be reading as believers.
Okay. And then two, what do you think about, like, the Christian equivalent of these, like Christian fiction that is romance related or whatever?
You know, even if there's not adulterous sexual relationships in these stories, you can, as a woman, spend too much time in the romance fantasy world. It just adds to that tendency to build a list of a guy you're looking for that is a dream guy, and he doesn't exist because he's made up in your mind. You want to be building a list that's made up of real qualities that a human man can live up to. And so anything that goes into that fantasy romance genre, you really do have to be careful, because you're just setting yourself up for disappointment.
All right. Not that we're giving the big diss to the Christian writers out there. We still support you. But definitely a good encouragement, Candace, to young, you know, Christian single women, just even as a time issue, to budget your time and realize that, yeah, sitting and reading novel after novel after novel when you should be out building relationships and serving your church and whatever is probably the better use of your time anyway, and learning from real women who ultimately will help you move down that path towards,
you know,
marriage.
One thing I would add is that if you really want to read stories, skip the fiction for a while. If you're struggling with that, go to biographies and read about real people. Read about Christian women who were heroes of the faith. Read about Amy Carmichael and Susanna Wesley and Mother Teresa and all of these great women, Corrie Ten Boom, because not only will you be getting the benefit of a good story, but you'll be getting the benefit of learning from their wise example.
All right, Candace, that is good feedback and definitely helpful for not only this listener, but also the women out there who probably are struggling with this issue. Okay, we will close the Boundless inbox. As always, we solicit your feedback and your questions. We would love to hear from you and would love to hear what is weighing on your mind or what kind of questions and comments you have. We always strive to answer those, so please write us at editor@boundless.org, and we will do our best to address those. And that's it for this week's edition of The Boundless Show. As always, tell your friends, make sure that you subscribe if you have not already. And until next week, I'm your host, Lisa Anderson.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org, focus on the family.